You are listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource, and we are grateful to all of our listeners who help keep us the podcast going by donating to the show. We are also grateful and proud to be supported by the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies.
In our last episode, we went into quite a bit of detail on Carl Weick's The Vulnerable System, where he referred to actions between air traffic controllers and pilots in a very stressful circumstance. That is was a very important article. And now we're going to take a different look at resilience. We're going to go into more detail on Pauli's 2009 article about reclaiming resilience. So there's built in that title is some notion that resilience has either been lost or there's been a great damage to the organization. Pauli's emphasis is on what are the mechanisms that activate or reactivate resilience, because it just doesn't pop out of a box, despite what I might have thought before. And so it's wonderful insight, and I think it has a lot to do with how we'll be coping post-coronavirus, presuming we get into a post-coronavirus. I mean, that's probably coming, and I don't want to be too predictive about those kinds of things. But I think Pauli gives us lots of reasons to pause and think about, well, what is it that enables long-term organizational performance and resilience over the long term in terms of the social systems of the organization? And he creates a model based on interviews that he did with people after a shooting incident at a business school, which is typically not the kind of behavior you would expect at a business school. And that's one of the things I've always thought was interesting about these stressful environments. It's really easy to say, well, they should just, you know, the building blew up and it's not a big deal. But this idea that the difference between what people expect when they go to work, you know, what their normal expectations are, and then somebody running around with a gun trying to kill them is enormous. And in fact, there are many parallels between what people feel and post-traumatic stress. It's just a different way for the mechanism to be enacted. So we're going to think a little bit more and focus a little bit more on what we found particularly insightful about Pauli's article, Reclaiming Resilience and Safety.
So I can tell a bit about how I actually stumbled upon this this wonderful paper by Pauli. During my master's studies, I had a very fun project going on together with my colleague David Passenier. We were both studying in at the VU Amsterdam, and we were interested in this concept of liminality. And we both have a background in the social sciences, David in anthropology, and me coming from a psychology background, actually. And we saw this uptake of liminality in organization studies. And it was used in all various things, so we decided to do a lit review, and that's how we stumbled upon this paper. And so a little bit of background on this concept, where it comes from. It comes from anthropology. It was Victor Turner who first introduced it, and it's part of a ritual. When you have a ritual or a rite de passage, as he wrote about it, you have, when you think about, you know, like cultural tribes, for instance, you go through a ritual when you are introduced in, like, for instance, the transition from being a child to an adult. You have the pre-ritual setting, the state of being with roles and role relations. Then you go into the ritual where everything becomes liminal, becomes suspended. So the rules and societal norms and social relations that were before are not there anymore. And then you have post-ritual. So it creates this space for improvising, for creativity, and for new roles and role relations and connections to emerge that cannot emerge prior to the ritual because of the fixed role relations and processes, social processes as they go. And this insight was what a group of scholars in the 90s and 2000s found very interesting to also think like, okay, how can we use this concept to shed light on certain things that we see in organizations, organizational dynamics and the social processes that happen within organizations. And I think, you know, this study by Pauli really beautifully illustrates this by, you know, where the shooting disrupted the existing social relations within the business school, how the dean behaved. You would never just randomly walk into an assistant professor and say, hey, let's have lunch together. How are you? How are you doing? Are you coping? No, that would all be, you know, agenda invitation and secretary and whatnot. And so you see like how this business school shooting disrupted the existing structures and relations among people, students, support staff, academics, and how basically that opened up a space for new types of relations to emerge. And the paper there is quite positive. You can see that the people that were interviewed had quite central roles. They wanted to be heard in the interviews about what they did and so on. So we can talk about that. But it really illustrates like this beautiful concept from anthropology and how it can be used to understand these social changes that are happening. And I think also what organizations can learn from this study about, you know, how can they cope? Because we're in a crisis right now. I think we're still in a liminal state, in liminal suspension, as we all work from home and are still adjusting.
So Greta gave a great overview of the broader agenda of the paper, and I wanted to connect it a bit more on some of the ideas we were talking before. Yeah, so this paper starts from that was introduced by Vaikkanen, that he was trying to shift the focus towards and very much zoom in into those more social and emotion affective aspects as very much mechanisms behind resilience. And also what is interesting is that while I think most of the studies by Vaikkanen and other people have been post facto, and they were trying to draw lessons from disasters and crises, this one's trying to see how in the crisis in itself, there is something that is happening that is make possible resilience to be activated and has an implication for the way people then live, you know, and how to say digest what happened to them, and, you know, whether or not the experience cast a long shadow, you know. And I know that some people that study IT incidents, for example, Mohamed Hossein and my supervisor Dav Nicolini, that they recently did a literature review, and they pointed exactly that, on how the discussion very much tends to focus on learning that comes after or sometimes before incidents, but not necessarily during that. So it's interesting that the paper is shifting, I think, the scope into two aspects: the mechanisms they are going to bring forward, but also the locus of the resilience, so to speak, or the source.
I really thought Pedro's observation hit it on the head, following Greta's, which is this idea that resilience is something that's created. And that I think there's a really good, and the learning while in the crisis, both of you touched on that. And a comment from the paper that I really enjoy is that resilience is a socially enacted and embedded phenomenon. That is really insightful. And I'm going to play off something that the other people talked about. So it's not, I can't claim credit for this. I'm sick and tired of all these economists writing about COVID-19 and stress, because, and I know my other members of the team feel the same way, because it's really the social scientists and the organizational scientists that understand this better. And great, the economists have some great numbers on death rates and discovery and all those kinds of things, but the resilience that we need is this social phenomenon. And apparently the organizational scholars are writing about different things, or they're busy, or they're staying indoors. And we have some challenges, because if we're going to interview somebody, you can't be face to face with them anymore. I recognize those are challenges, and I thought both of you identified that in the moment creation of resilience, that's something that you enact or embed. That's what Pedro talked about, and then Greta was was talking about this different focus and learning in the crisis as opposed to, and then how the liminality, and I know Michael wants to talk about that, but that liminality is fascinating to me because as an engineer, I tend to think of borders as pretty important between this system and that system and inside of the pipe and outside of the pipe. And yet in social systems, it's a lot messier and the borders change and can move. And we enact that by the way we walk up to an assistant professor and say, let's have lunch or let's talk during lunch and how are you? And one of the things I wondered about in the article was, I wonder how long this persisted, right? Did it go back to normal? Were these people forever changed? And that really wasn't the focus of the article. Just something that I think about, that I think that people who go through these things, it's transformative for them. It's not, oh, I just had this one episode I once cared about what the dean thought or these students. I wonder if they ever think the same way again because it has such an impact on their life.
Yeah, so following up on that, I mean, if we look at the corona crisis, it's hard to say what's the beginning of the crisis? What's the how long will it take? Are we already towards post-crisis, moving towards post-crisis? Are we still in the midst of the crisis? So there are all these kind of questions of liminality and related to that also our identity. So this phase of liminality creates a lot of space, and actually the concept itself is also it described as three dimensions, so spatial, temporal, and social. And the article very much touches on the social dimension of liminality, and I think that's also something we experience in this situation, right? So I'm kind of in a sudden way I'm connected to other colleagues. The first question I asked my students if we have a Microsoft Teams meeting is, how are you doing? Of course, this is something I ask in class as well, but now it's got a different angle on there, for a much more personal aspect. I also see their rooms, like I see your offices or rooms now during this recording. I'm in my home, so am I a assistant professor? Am I a father? How are these things connected? There are all these kinds of questions that come up on your about your identity in this whole situation of working from home during this corona crisis.
Completely agree. And what I like so much about this Pauli paper is how he kind of gives us a vocabulary to talk about things we're all experiencing right now. And I thought maybe we can dive into, you know, these other two concepts that are very important in the paper. And one of them is this compassionate witnessing, which I think you already hinted at, Michael. And, you know, like, probably we have all these kinds of instances of, when we think about this concept of compassionate witnessing, that we see, like, within our own context we are working right now. And then he talks about this relational redundancy, this other term, and I found that one a little bit more difficult to grasp, but I thought there might be interesting links there with the close-knit and the loose-knit systems that Mike was talking about. I'd love to hear your perspective.
Well, I think that's a great way to look at it, because it's that coupling, right? You focus on the coupling.
Exactly.
Between the systems. So if the social relations are another way, you know, Pedro likes to talk about this is not just multiple dimensions, it's XD, these social interactions or these connections, and they're not just social. So I think that is a wonderful way to think about it, because the interactions can change and you can think differently about them. And Michael's comment about identity was also quite insightful, because if you think about it, a lot of ways that identity gets generated is from the things you do, right? I'm a cook, I cook for my family, or I'm a professor, so I stand up in a lecture hall and I give these lectures. Well, is your identity impacted when you no longer are lecturing from a hall, you're lecturing from a screen, or you're interacting with your students? on a screen. And I hear many people say, oh, after coronavirus, no one's ever going to go to university anymore. They'll just do it all online. And I think that's a very limited way to look at it. I do realize it's an option. As Pedro likes to often point out, we're humans after all. And so we crave and value that interaction. And as Michael was saying, I value the fact that I can see other people. Unfortunately, our audience can't, except for the guests that we have, can't appreciate that. But it, I think it makes the interaction so much more rich when you have this ability to connect with people. And I think this idea of compassionate witnessing is really interesting. There's a really good quote from the book, and it says, the author writes, sharing stories of the trauma helped the participants feel relief, not isolation. Sharing and connecting enabled a focus on relationships, which is what Greta was talking about, and how they can be modified by something like this, and the social connections, which is exactly what Greta was talking about, where we now have a different kind of coupling in the organization. So I think both of those are really interesting ways or useful ways to look at this dynamic.
So one thing, Ralph, that I think is very different in the current situation than the Pauli case is that in the Pauli case, after the shooting, there was a lot of emergent, impromptu gathering of people. People that were not necessarily connecting before or in the what Pauli describes is they connected on an equal basis rather than in a fixed hierarchy or set of role relations. But what we see now is role remote. Why is it that exactly we are gathering in this podcast and we don't have other new people joining? Is because we don't meet them. Like what we see now, at least that's my experience, is that existing relations get strengthened, but there is not so much opportunity to meet new people. And there's a little paragraph in the Pauli paper where he does recognize that people that are at the borders of the organization and are less connected, experienced way less compassionate witnessing. They actually said they would have loved, he has this fragment where an assistant professor that recently joined said he would have loved the dean to reach out to him to ask he was okay, because very soon after the shooting he had to start teaching. You know, it was a major thing that happened, and then he just had to go back to the usual. And yet, you know, like I also changed departments shortly before we had to go into social isolation. And the people that I'm connecting more with at this moment are from my previous department than the new one. And I was like, so why is this? Because there are not these opportunities to connect. So this compassionate witnessing plays out very, very differently, I feel, when we're in a remote operations, rather than when you have physical, in-person, spontaneous gathering. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, on if there are other things you think, like where are the similarities now and where are the differences?
So I'm going to build on that. And I think one of the things I like about the podcast is that sometimes I have ideas that are unorganized and I see someone touching them in a different way and manipulating a different way that kind of clarify what I was thinking. So that was actually just happened. Because when I was reading the paper, and you gave the example from your own experience, Greta, right? That in situations of crisis, you know, people rely on their ties and everything, and all these things happen because the normal days is suspended, you know, all the stuff that we just talked about. But it is unclear in the paper, and well, I'm not complaining or anything, it's just like it's beyond the focus, the mechanism, because I think the paper lists the anatomy of what is happening, it's not necessarily explains the physiology, you know, or the origins of that. And as you say, I suspect that the fact that it was in one organization and probably the, you know, these all processes emerge within people that already had some ties or some familiarity or some sense of common purpose, you know, there is a bunch of mechanisms that people have studied that produce this kind of positive relations, you know, and he cites the work of Jody Hoffer-Gittel that has exactly studied this kind of stuff, you know, how it is produced. And where did I want to go with that? Yeah, exactly, because that is exactly one of the things that I was wondering, is that where does it come from and how it differentiates and why do we see in such a way in this context, you know, and why it is not in others. So I was reflecting a little about that, you know, I felt that it was a piece of the puzzle, you know, for future research, so to speak, that I was a bit missing.
Yeah, and I want to come back also to the aspect of liminality related to this, because the compassionate witnessing, I agree with Greta. It's very much in the paper focused on the people that are actually most involved probably in the crisis. But if you look at the concept of liminality, it's also referring to this whole idea of waiting, of a loss of social status, of a loss of sense of community, a loss of confidence. And these aspects are also very much, should also be very much visible, I guess, in the case. And I do see them also within the current crisis and how difficult it is to keep a sense of community, not only among scholars within the department, but also with my group of master students or bachelor students. We want to have them within a community that they learn from each other as well. And it's hard, very hard to see if that's happening, if they find each other in this time of crisis and in this time of working from home and remote work. It's very, very hard if they identify themselves still as students. We also had last week an email from one of our secretaries at the department who actually wrote, like, I don't know what value I add to the organization, right? So I'm now working from home and I do the things that come by, but in a way I also feel lost and confused about what I can mean to the organization. And this more critical aspect is kind of absent in the article.
Can I just respond quickly to that? And I think exactly what I thought it is. We know from literature that things like goal, you know, a common goal, a clear goal, a goal that in which people can see themselves represented, or the nature of the dyadic ties or the common ground that exists between people. These are all like mechanisms that people studied that produce some of that he's hitting at, you know. And the fact that you give this example, I think, just further illustrates it on how when this, you know, because in a way what I felt is that this is a story of a very functional and, you know, healthy organization in which when things collapse in such a way, the existence of this other infrastructure, you know, makes possible for all this to emerge. But then the question is, like, when you do not have that, when you have people that do not feel part of the goal, or you have tensions, whatever it is.
I agree, Pedro. One of the things that I was thinking of is, you know, like, when you read the paper, you see that some of these insights about, you know, the role of social networks and social relations is based upon the work of Gittel. I hope I pronounced it correctly. And, you know, there are assumptions about employment here. And again, I think we cannot understand organizational dynamics without understanding the employment conditions of the people working in the organization. And what I think is also different now in the corona crisis, when you think about this relational redundancy, and to briefly explain, well, at least make an effort, please join in to clarify this concept, it kind of is this idea that you have overlapping social networks, and by these loose ties, you kind of can reach everyone, because not if you have a big organization, you don't know everyone. And especially when there's a shooting, you want to know who is in the building, who is safe. And this close-knit, like mobile text messages from this person to that, they very quickly could get an understanding of who is safe, who is in the building, who needs help, who was tremendously traumatized by the shooting, and they had to focus on. But now what you see, like if we start from the thought experiment that we're still in a liminal suspension as we're working remote, we have some networks that are there, like people in important staff positions, academics, and they all have their networks, informal networks within the organization where you have this compassionate witnessing, like, hey, checking in, are you okay? For instance, I regularly check in with Pedro, like, hey, how are you doing? Because we're all alone in our flats in social isolation. But if you have, if this relational redundancy, this term, when you think of now, all organizations are in crisis. Business schools and universities alike expect way less income for next year. So they put a freeze on the hiring. They got rid of a lot of support staff like cleaners and whatnot. And so gaps emerge in the network. And so you have less overlap. Yeah, and so thinking about, you know, like one thing that is not addressed in the Pauli paper is the employment conditions, that everybody stayed employed during this crisis because, you know, people only had to stay home for 10 days for the police to do their investigations, I assume. But now, you know, we might possibly be working from home for months. And, you know, like there are stories now that people in the job market, their job offers are withdrawn, thinking about, you know, all the, yeah, I already mentioned it, like blue collar work that just like, you know, the whole foundation of the university as an organization operate. And I assume that also is true for many other organizations. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, there's so much to react to. It's wonderful. And a couple of different things. So I'll probably write to Greta first, and then I'm going to go backwards because Michael and Pedro said there's some really interesting things. I think that's really interesting, that this idea that we're still in the crisis. I think Greta hit the nail on the head when she talked about that. That's a huge difference from where we are now, for what the paper was talking about, because it was after the crisis and they were able to see these mechanisms. And then I think Michael was the one who said, Michael or Greta said, we can't interact the same way in the paper because it's not allowed. It's fundamental to the social distancing that we're doing, that if you get together to try to meet new people in Greta's department, a drone is going to come by, and next thing you know, the police are going to come by and tell you to disperse. And so it's a much different dynamic. And one of the things that Michael said that made me think more about this, because I love his focus on the liminality. And that is that you could read the paper as it's one directional. And in fact, I think that's how he shows the arrows. You have this liminality, and that sets in place these social interactions and the social relations. And the way Michael describes it, it made me think, I really think it's bidirectional. And Pedro was talking a little bit about that too, where it was a continuum, or I forget exactly the word you used, but it was this idea that it goes both ways. And you do some things in social relations that affect the liminality, and liminality affects the social relations. And so I think it's a richer understanding not to see it. I'm not saying there was an error in the paper, but I think Michael draws attention to this richer understanding you can have of the connection between liminality and compassionate witnessing and the rebuilding. And that's what's really interesting. It's as if the social relations, and this isn't really true, but one way to think about it is it's as if they just fell to the ground. Like you could draw them on a board, and you have all these connections, you would say, well, here's where Greta is in the department, and here's where the dean is, and here's who she works for. And then all of a sudden, like a cartoon animation, it just dropped. And the people are still there, but the connections now are not quite, that have to be the same, or you might invent new ones. And I think the fact that we're in the middle of them makes that harder. But what I was thinking about when both Pedro and Greta were talking about this, and Michael said in motion, and then I'll finish, was that maybe because it is different in this case, we have to think differently about constructing those social relations. So, and we have to say, well, I can't do a departmental party or event or social gathering, but I can do something different, or I can, even if it has to be Zoom or something, or, but we have to be a little bit more creative, because I think in the case of the paper, it was easier. I don't want to say it was easy, but it was easier because it didn't have the restrictions. So now we have to be more creative. And those of us who recognize the benefits, as Greta was describing them, of these new connections, have to say, we need a new mechanism. We need to rethink how those get built, because we don't know how long we're going to be here. And so it's not productive to say, well, I'll do this when the crisis is over. Probably not so productive, right? Because our holding space is bigger. So what's a different way to think about that? And that's what I liked about what all three of you did, is brought different perspectives to that idea of that reconstructing of the social relations.
So I have a quick reaction to that as well, in trying to be more positive, because it is true that the type of crisis we are in is different and so on and so forth. But I was thinking as well, I think one positive difference maybe is that since we are all, and I think we in the broadest possible sense, is almost like humanity, living through it, it then it normalizes emotional work. Because one thing that I found interesting in the paper is that there is a lot of emotional work being done, and usually there is a gender aspect to this kind of behaviors and so on and so forth. But here it seems that these distinctions became less important and just became normalized to act in such a way. And I feel the same way that now that we are in such a condition, you know, people, and Michael was responding, like I'm giving examples of that, we naturally become more attentive, or our bias against it maybe diminishes, you know. So it becomes a different, I think, a way to, it creates a possibility for that, for a different way to engage with people.
To follow up on the positive notion of Pedro, the whole paper, of course, is kind of in a positive mood. That's why it kind of hit me in the heart, right? So it gives a good vibe in dealing with a crisis. Of course, it's about resilience, and it made me think: do we have a positive management studies? We do have critical management studies. So do we have positive management studies? Would be interesting to to do something with that.
We have it.
Okay, that's great.
That's progress for you. So, one comment I wanted to just reflect on was that I wanted to make this point earlier, and then Michael, we'll go back to you. I was actually in an organization that went through almost this exact same thing. So it wasn't a graduate school. It was a Navy organization I won't mention because it's not important. But somebody had been fired. They didn't take his security badge, sort of the classic error you make in these cases. So he came back the next day. He'd had a history. Of course, everybody can notice the history of mental instability after the person goes on a rampage, but it's not so easy to act on in real time. And he came back, and I think he killed 7 people, and it wasn't random. He hunted people down at their desks, and I heard people who were there at the time. I wasn't doing a study, but I heard what they talked about, very, very similar to the comments that you see in the paper. And one of the things that really struck out to me was this idea that how strongly people respond to this notion of being hunted. That somebody was looking for them to hunt them down and kill them. This individualizing aspect was amazingly stressful for people. And then how they, and so as Michael and both Michael and Peter were saying, you can look at this from the dark side, but you can also, one of the things that's amazing about this is the resilience human beings have. So I'm very encouraged. Yes, I know there's some bad things that go on, but I think it's very encouraging because when you see tremendous exogenous shocks to a system or an organization like this, you can look at the negative things about how it causes difficulties for people. But I think what's really important is this amazing capacity we have to start anew. And yes, people are damaged psychologically and they have challenges. And yet, this was a wonderful case of an organization that basically rediscovered itself, refound its resilience, and created it. And so I think I'm always very optimistic about things like that. You got to be careful because it sounds like you don't care very much if you emphasize too much on that. But that is actually one of the wonderful things about the organizations we humans create. And maybe it's not every organization, but it is more common than you might think. And I think it's wonderful that our attention is attracted to it through this piece.
Yeah, and in relation to that resilience and also more specifically the relational redundancy that's been mentioned before, I kind of read that as positive as well, right? So he and I quote, "Counterintuitively, the focus turns from organizational efficiencies toward redundancy, excess relational capacity, and slack relational resources." So in a way, he states like, the focus of organizations switches from efficiency towards this relational aspect, and that's something I think we very much see happening if we look at the more aspects of IT and innovation that are now very rapidly implemented within the health system, the mobile health, e-health aspects. Also, we teachers working with all these kinds of IT aspects, that's all of a sudden this is being implemented, and it's redundantly being implemented, I would say. There are all these kind of open Google documents that are emailed around. You can, there's so much information available and actively pushed towards you, like which kind of platforms there are, what kind of tools you can use in education, working from home. And that's something I kind of, was able to make better sense of through this idea of relational redundancy.
So what I think we can kind of, I'm kind of reflecting upon, like, putting these two studies next to each other and what we can learn from them. And one of the things that keeps coming back in my head is this thing of shifting gears. And the realization, as an organization, you have to shift gears. And what you see, both papers kind of touch upon this thing, and this recognition when it has to happen. And what you see is often you need someone high in the authority ladder, high in the hierarchy, to approve that shifting gears is okay, because a person that is supporting it doesn't feel comfortable to do that. And you saw that in the cockpit, like if the co-pilot had taken more, had a more prominent role, what happened in the KLM cockpit, things might have gone very different. But also in the Pauli paper, There is a big acknowledgement of the positive effects that shifting gears and establishing and having, like, letting go of the role relations and relating on the basis of humanity, of being but all in the same situation and having to deal with a trauma or with a crisis, and going from there. So it's the recognition, an authority figure that has to give this sign of approval that's okay. And then it's like, okay, how can you make sure that this compassionate witnessing, this taking care of each other, checking in if you're all right, and if you feel you're in a position to resume your work, is happening? Because the person in leadership in an organization is well connected. He will have a lot of attention from other people checking in with him. But, like a third subordinate that just joined an organization, or someone coming back from paternity leave that has been out for a while, or someone that was on sick leave when everything happened, they might be well connected. And how do you make sure these people, and especially the vulnerable people in your organization, do get the same type of inclusion? And I think that's like a key management challenge now as we're remote. And, you know, like the way we connect with each other is more based on existing relations and connections where we feel there's a trusting relationship, rather than just reaching out to a complete stranger and building that up from scratch.
Greta talked about the shift in terms of the way we organize and the purpose we organize for, you know, when we have the shift that it's not just the production aspect, so to speak, you know, achieving the goal, but also we are called upon ourselves to, you know, organize and interact based on humanity and support each other. And you know, one thing I just wanted to reflect, you know, that in a way, this broader literature on disasters in the social sciences have very much documented that on how social ties is an important central mechanism. There is the work of Aldrich on that. There is the work of Eric Klinenberg on the work that he did on the heat wave that happened in Chicago, and very much shows that anomie, a traditional classic sociological concept, can explain why certain people, you know, and why certain neighborhoods were more or less affected. So ties do matter, you know, so I think that's the overall message here. But I wanted to talk about something else in closing, is that thinking about our current situations, no, sorry, I'll go later. So ties do matter. And it's interesting because here I see a connection with the work of Veik. You know, we talked about teamwork and roles and connection and systems. It's just this, we have seen a different aspect in which all this interconnection can be understood. But besides that, what I thought is that in light of what we are living today, one thing that seems that the paper showcases, and I mentioned it before, is how emotional work has become normalized in this context, which means that certain values have become, I think, more, have come to the forefront. And thinking on the way people talk about the crisis we are living today, there is a lot of war-like vocabulary that is used. But at the same time, I think that the paper, in a way, showcases the possibility of how resilience can be founded on a different notion, such as care. And I think that is, I think, an important lesson for the way we think about our role right now, and the way we think about the way we organize and what is important to consider. You know, so what it would mean maybe to basis our response and base the way we organize and interact with other people in this situation, not with an image such as this kind of, you know, combative-like, but more about inclusivity, participation, care-like.
That's a great way to look at it. Both of you hit on this idea of social relations and emotional work or environment being really important. And Pedro, I really wasn't thinking too carefully about it until you just said it, this idea that the war-like attacking metaphors or defensive metaphors, it's all about barriers and inoculating and those kinds of things. And yet you and Greta both indicated that the emotional work is also important, that this is damaging to people in many different ways. And largely what you see people saying is, well, there'll be more psychological problems, right? And then they're done talking about it. They move on to other things. And what you two are emphasizing is it goes much deeper than that. And I think that this article has helped us see that. And I think Greta and Michael have talked about this importance of the relations, these affective relations. In fact, that is one of the things, this emotional work and the relations are the things that were the breakthroughs for crew resource management, because we realized, oh no, it's not just about the technical issues of the cockpit, right? Pedro knows about how aviation designers function and they look at interfaces, but they can only go so far. They can't recommend to the airlines, here's how we think you ought to relate. And that was the breakthrough of the airlines themselves saying, no, our work goes beyond that. And then Greta really pointed out well, there are these times when you need, your priority needs to change, and it's really important. It's not like you're saying efficiency isn't important. You're concluding it's not the most important thing now because other priorities really need to get our attention. And in the case of the cockpit, their priority was get off the ground, get the passengers to their place, to the airport, make sure the hotel reservations didn't expire. That really wasn't the world they were in, and it's hard to pull out of that or see yourself differently in the middle of that, which I think is what one of the things Greta emphasized. And that's what this article can help us to see is that, you know, it's a disengagement in realizing your priorities need to be different. And it doesn't mean efficiency and getting work done and educating students and those kinds of things aren't important, but they're really not what you need right now because you need to start building something a bit different. That's why, there's some research recently from operating rooms. They have a challenge with teamwork, and many organizations have this problem where the teams aren't consistent. it's a team of people, but they're not always in the same roles, or it's not always the same people. So in the case of an operating room, you might have a surgeon, but a different chief nurse, different anesthesiologist. They all come together in this adhocracy, as it were, much like movies do. And Wyke has written about that as well. And they found out that one of the, so how do you, you can't push a button and get people to say, oh, I'm part of a team now, and I should care about what Michael thinks because he's the anesthesiologist. I should listen to him more carefully. Just humans don't work that way. So one of the things they found in research is just a simple briefing where each member of the team introduces themselves, whether they know each other or not, and say, hi, I'm Ralph. I'm the anesthesiologist. My role today is to do X. And then they go to Greta, and Greta is the chief nurse or chief surgical nurse, and she says what she's supposed to do. And it's they have found that the connection that starts, which is what Michael was also referring to, that connection starts, they get started, is a wonderful way to build resilience and reliability, as Greta pointed out, in the moment, during the event, not afterwards. Because once the patient's heart stops beating, you don't, it's a different kind of resilience. And I'm not trying to be morbid about this, but I just do think that emphasis on there are times when the emotional work is just as important as the technical, hierarchical connection. And people in hierarchy, like Greta pointed out, is my last comment on this, must have to see that they play a very, very important role for creating that freedom and that space. So that was a wonderful insight.
I love your point, Ralph, and to talk in warlike terms, especially for people at the front line. These are very valid insights. I'm kind of thinking of stealing the point.
Go ahead, go ahead.
Please join in. These economists would never mention these things.
Yeah, they had the idea first. I stole it from both of those two, but it was wonderful that the kind of things that we think are important, that are really are of a lasting importance to resilience, just isn't on the radar of economists. God bless them.
Stop interviewing economists about organizations.
So there is this Twitter account that is women know stuff as well, which is about social scientists that are women, and they tweet papers and all that. And I think we should, like, I'm thinking maybe, like, not even, like, a t-shirt. I'm thinking, like, a billboard or some kind of, you know, artistic intervention. There is this artist that I love, Jenny Hoser, that she does this, she works with words, and she uses a lot of billboards to make funny plays. So there's one that I have it here, that she had this on a billboard on a big city, which was commentary on it says, consumption.
So for our listeners only, it's protect me from what I want.
So it's,
which I need help with
like
all the
that,
time.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. You may not know this, but we really love receiving feedback from our listeners. So if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some of the best people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Riener, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Karamustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Pix Kraft, Timothy Paul, Willy Lechton-Wirta, and Gabriel Van Bonnen. And I apologize if I mispronounced your name. You are still the best and we love you so much. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website where a donations button will greet you. You can't miss it. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you next time for the next episode here on Talking About Organizations.